super excited to have FIFA referee Matthew Conger on the podcast today. Matthew is a New Zealand referee, born in the States, refereed in the A-League and obviously in the World Cup in 2018 in Russia, and is now joining us from Abu Dhabi, where he's potentially officiating in the Club World Cup. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us. How's the weather there?
My pleasure to join you. It is beautiful weather here, and have to say, probably a bit fortunate when most of the world is going into winter. We get to enjoy the delights of very lovely Abu Dhabi.
Yeah. Weather. So when we chat to the referees on our podcast, the first thing we love to answer it or ask is, what's your earliest memory in football? How did you fall in love with the game?
Well, my earliest memory in football was actually not necessarily on a football pitch, but it was on the back porch of my parents' home in Athens, Georgia, where I grew up, sitting on the swing, talking to my dad. Maybe I was 10 years old, and talking about how all I could think about was that I wanted to play for my country. I wanted to play professional football. Wow. And it was even in a time when, you know, I grew up in the States and even in the South, where most kids are playing baseball or American football or basketball. And, so I was a little bit, an odd fish in that regard, but, I grew up playing and that was, you know, very much, and it's always been a very important part mm-hmm. of my life.
And you started playing when you were 10 or even younger than that?
I think I was seven, okay. Maybe seven or eight. Yep. At the YMCA in Athens. Nice. And, yeah, started, I was initially a striker because I was, the tallest kid on yep. my team. And, so got to score lots of goals. And then one day that became a goalkeeper and then all of a sudden, and they couldn't get me yep. up. And, so yeah, I played up through to, the Olympic development level in the States and then was actually set to go to Georgia State College for to play and mm-hmm. study. And then had a bit of a change of mind okay. and decided to travel the world. And one thing led to another. And
things changed.
Ended up on the that's right.
So is that so you when you went traveling, is that obviously how the New Zealand connection came in? You just went out there and just fell in love with the place, or was it a little bit more complicated?
More fell in love with the woman. I was living in Copenhagen, Denmark, and I was actually refereeing there a bit as well, and met my wife. We spent a month working together, really kind of hit it off and thought, well, this is pretty cool. So, and followed her back down to New Zealand and have been there since, one with a brief stint back in the States and then, now full-time back in New Zealand since 2006.
Amazing. There's worse places that she could have come from.
indeed there Brilliant. Are.
So you mentioned there, you were refereeing in your time in Denmark. And so when did you first make that transition into refereeing? Was it when you finished playing or were you doing it side by side?
Yep. I started refereeing when I was 15. So and at the time it was, you know, it's a good way to make some cash, going and refereeing under 10 games on a Saturday night or Saturday evening and then going and playing on Sunday or the rest of the weekend, and continued through, basically played and refereed depending on the schedule and seasons and whatnot, through until I was 18, and then brief pause while when I moved away, but then carried on with my refereeing and played a little bit more after that as well. But again, sort of jumping back to that, you know, sitting on the back porch with mm-hmm. my dad, you know, it was always a passion to play or be involved in the game at the highest level. And, you know, and I could see it became apparent that, well, okay, I'm not going to do this as a player, but I was having success as a referee. And again, even, you know, it opened some doors for me in Denmark, being able to referee there. And so, hey, that became more and more of the drive and the focus of, you know, what I could do and achieve, you know, at that level as a referee.
I think it's a pretty common journey that I've heard pretty much every kind of one elite referee has said, you know, I always aspired to be an elite professional player. And then there was a ceiling that came.
That's
right. Luckily, I've been doing refereeing at the same time, and kind of that took over. And it's interesting to hear. I think that's pretty much, if you ask most referees who start out at the bottom levels now, they say, you know, I love playing, and I'm just not good enough. I want to give back, and then maybe they see this. They referee just to give back, and then they fall in love with the feeling of being on the pitch and exactly. orchestrating the game. So no, it's great.
That's right, and it's critical to have that passion and love for the game. And you see the best referees, whether it's you know, locally or internationally, the best referees are the ones that have that feeling for the game and remember what it's like to be a player, and they have that ability to, obviously they know the laws and they, you know, you have to know what mm-hmm. you're doing. But having that empathy for players and, you know, that passion for what you're doing, it becomes quite evident. You can see those that have that more so yeah. than others.
So you did the course, the refereeing course, when you were in the States. Can you remember back yep. to that? Like, was it sat in a room reading the laws of the game book, yeah. or were you out on the field, yeah. or how did it work? Because I think it's evolved since then.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I don't think it was. I cannot remember any. There must have been some practical element mm-hmm. to it, but it was in the basement of the YMCA in Athens. I can remember the, you know, that smell of chlorine and sweat, and you know, I'm pretty sure all, you know, sort of those sort of facilities kind of have that smell about yeah. them. I remember, yeah, it was a basement, and we went through. It was, I'm pretty sure, a whole weekend course, and you know, culminating with laws of the game test at the end, which of course we all had to pass, and then. I was given a set of flags and cards and a whistle,
and then off you go. So you've done your course, and can you remember, you know, that first day when you blew the whistle? Were you in the middle, or were you an assistant? Can you remember that first game?
No. I from memory, I was. It would have been an under 10 match on a Friday night. Went out and I think maybe somebody came and watched okay. me. Just to make sure that everything was okay. But I remember it being, you know, pretty straightforward. It was, I learned pretty quickly, especially with that age group, that actually, again, that whole enabling the game. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I didn't want to constantly be blowing the whistle. So there was a little bit of, even then, a bit of coaching yep. around, okay, no, that's not the right way to throw the ball in. Let's try that again. You know, so I didn't, you know, blow the whistle to start the game and finish the game just about, and not too much in between. Every now and again, there was a foul that you couldn't, you know, that it was like, all right, okay, right, I have to blow the whistle now. But I learned pretty quickly that you had to it's about enabling the game and being a part of it rather than necessarily just, you know, being officious.
Yeah. I think that's a great place to learn. Well, there'll be two schools of thoughts, but a great place to learn is in youth soccer, because you as a referee have to some degree coach. Mm. You're learning yourself. Mm-hmm. Obviously mm-hmm. there's other challenges there with parents and coaches, and mm-hmm. but it is a good place to learn if you've got people around you that can support you.
Absolutely.
And kind of looking back through your career, so when did you realize, so you mentioned when you moved to New Zealand, okay, maybe refereeing was my pathway to the top. Is that where mm-hmm. you kind of started the kind of climbing the ladder, was in New Zealand? And how did your kind of refereeing journey go from when you moved there?
Uh-huh. Well, it was already starting. It started some in the States already. Mm-hmm. I guess with my desire, my choice to go and do some traveling and whatnot, that it wasn't necessarily smooth at that mm-hmm. point. A little bit of stop and start. So, but it wasn't until, because in the States, I was doing high school games and eventually doing university games, as well as USSF matches and whatnot, amateur games okay. there. But then it wasn't until moving to New Zealand where the pathway, and it is a smaller pond, mm-hmm. I suppose, in that sense. The pathway to the international level is a lot faster. Yep. It comes with its own set of challenges in terms of what we have to sort of navigate also on the world mm-hmm. scene, but and how we kind of have to upskill ourselves. But that's when it really became, oh, okay, I really can get to first a FIFA badge, and then there is if I am able to be successful for that, then there is a legitimate chance of making it to a World Cup. So it was definitely in New Zealand that it became really very deliberate in the choices made to pursue.
Brilliant.
That.
So you set that goal pretty early on, I guess it sounds like.
Yes. Yep.
Having looked back, so you've refereed in New Zealand and in Australia. Is that quite common that elite referees in New Zealand would referee in the A-League? Is that?
I'm the... Now, it used to... Some of the a number of years ago, there was more involvement from the top New Zealand referees. Because Australia were part of OFC, mm-hmm. there was much more integration of maybe there were four or five guys on the league, I think, at one time refereeing, and that whittled down our last two World Cup referees, a guy named Mike Hester and Peter O'Leary, mm-hmm. Were both A-League referees as well. But at a time when I think the maximum there were three of us on the league. They were active, and I was a dedicated fourth official at the time. And then it's since now I'm the only referee involved from New Zealand on the A-League. We have three assistant referees and one VAR. But yeah, the numbers have kind of whittled down. And part of that's because Australia are now part of AFC. Mm-hmm. And of course, New Zealand's OFC. So
there's confederation.
Confederation differences and a little bit of, slightly different pathway.
Okay. Is there any kind of games you look back on that or specific decisions that you think, I wish I could do that again because I made a mistake, or vice versa. You got such a good buzz from a great decision that maybe no one else saw that you're like, oh, I wish I could relive that moment again, or I keep that in my mind when I go into games.
Standout sort of feelings and moments are really the biggest thing is being, having the best seat in the house for an amazing goal. Been the times when I've played advantage and it leads to a goal, and then you just sort of have those. Yeah, it just feels great. And, even sometimes near misses or, an outstanding save by a goalkeeper and being in that prime position to see, oh, shivers, if he doesn't, get a touch here or he loops it around into the top corner and, having the perfect vantage point for that. Those are, absolutely standout moments. And one of the probably in terms of a decision, one of the hardest, but also one of the ultimately it's become one of the more rewarding decisions for me. I incorrectly awarded a pen in the 2016 Olympics mm-hmm. In the Algeria Portugal game. And if we had VAR now, it would have been overturned. but it was not easy. It was very difficult in the sense that it finished my tournament for me. But it really spurred me into looking at how what I was doing, how I was refereeing, what I need to do with my team to develop more, what I need to do personally, in my own self in terms of just personal development and development as a referee, how to prevent this type of situation from happening again. So it was a difficult and absolutely I would change the decision if I could at the time, but it's also been hugely rewarding on the other side, looking at the growth and whatnot that's come out of that.
So it kind of
I feel better.
It spurred you on. Sounds like it kind of to the next level.
Indeed.
And then, kind of, as you're going, because you've been refereeing in many geographies, what was there any referee that you looked up to as you were coming up the ladder? Was there specific styles you wanted to emulate, or were there people around you that were supporting you that you wanted that were kind of enabling you to get better and better?
Growing up, it was the likes of Essie Bahamist and Brian Hall, you know, guys in the US that really, and Essie, and I've had the privilege of now being able to work with both of them more closely, probably with Essie, as he's been a FIFA instructor through the World Cup program, but also with Brian through his role with CONCACAF and now also with FIFA. So it's, you know, working with and receiving mentoring and coaching from, you know, childhood idols, you know, on the pitch is great. And both of them, you know, both of them are outstanding, you know, individuals. And then, you know, in the time, even over the last few years and even now, I mean, it's looking, I look around and I see, okay, well, what, you know, it's sort of like gleaming different bits from lots of really good top class referees from all around the world, you know, seeing, oh, how did you deal with that? Or what was your personality like in dealing with this situation? You know, that mixture of sometimes, you know, you have to be a bit of a play actor, you know, in terms of, you know, players need to, you know, you've got to get the message across sometimes verbally and non-verbally. And so it's gleaming all those things from lots of different guys, even my, you know, sort of colleagues, you know, it's like, oh, I like the way you did that. And okay, I'll steal that one.
It's important to kind of understand those different skill sets that a referee needs, right? And it's not just learning laws of the game, but it's actually most of it, I guess, at your level is probably more man management and selling decisions, I would assume, is pretty high up on the skill set. So taking those snippets of skills that other referees have and trying to understand what caused the referee needing to act in certain ways as well is key.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And finding, you know, finding my own style and who I am as a referee, and that, you know, each referee has their own style. You know, if you look at the great referees, you know, I mean, Kalina is you know, the most widely known, you know, in terms of his personality and, you know, the way he could use and still does use his eyes and his expression, but also just his manner and his presence, you know, on the field. And players quickly realize, or I think quickly begin to recognize that level of respect, both for, you know, it's mutual respect, and how you treat them, and you know, but at the ultimately as well, you have to have that authority to say, this is the way it is, and this is the way it's going to be. Certainly there were a number of years, a few, you know, sort of, I can remember times when, you know, receiving different coaching, oh, you should do it this way, and oh, you should do it this way, and oh, you should do it this way. And actually, it was what they were wanting, well-intentioned, but they were saying, oh, well, you know, more addressing their own kind of personality. Oh, I would do it this way, but I had to find my way of making sure that the decision was correct. And then how do I, as you say, manage that situation or manage the player in a way that suits
your personality,
the situation, and suits my personality, you know, because.
So you obviously had a amazing summer, it seemed, from afar. Out in Russia, it looked like an amazing experience. And like I said, you're now in Abu Dhabi at the Club World Cup, where many of the referee, or pretty much every referee there was in Russia too. So is it just like getting the gang back? Is everyone friendly and reminiscing of the stories? How is that experience now?
Oh, it is the refereeing community is very strong. Of course, they have the experience of working together to World Cup is, you know, it's a very special thing. And of course, we talk about different memories and moments that we've had together there. And it's great. It's always good, you know, getting guys back together. And we've got a couple of, especially assistants, a couple of new guys that are back into the program after being out for a while. So it's good to see everybody again. And
brilliant. And
yeah, this is a nice tournament. There's of course we have it's the club champion of the world. But being a smaller tournament, it's a nice small group of referees, and we train hard and work hard every day, but it's always has a nice feeling about it.
And in Russia, so take me back to that experience. Was it pretty clear that you knew you were going a year or two out, or was there still a lot of hard work to do before you got there?
Always a lot of hard work. We never, I learned fairly quickly that I don't kind of necessarily get too excited about an upcoming appointment until the, just about till I'm on the plane. I had a pretty good indication I was, going to be selected coming out of OFC as the main referee from our confederation, but you don't ever guarantee. And as well, I 6 weeks out from the World Cup, I fractured my foot right at the beginning of our last training camp in Coverciano in Italy, so that added a whole nother layer of, stress and pressure going into the tournament. With all the rehab and what that I needed to do to make sure that I was fit and healthy and ready to perform. And so that was, unfortunately I was, but, it was sort of just at the end, like, are we going to get there?
So just like any player that may have got injured in a similar time frame, it was rehab, and then trying to get mentally prepared as well while you're
exactly.
Must have been tough. So
exactly.
So then out in Russia, you arrived a couple of weeks before the tournament, I believe, or was it?
Yes. No. We were there. Yeah, we were 10 days. Okay. 10 days before the start of the tournament. So that's straight into pre-tournament camp. Mm-hmm. So we're training every day with players. Of course, we're working on continuing the work that we've been doing for the last 18 months around VAR implementation and whatnot, and just really a lot of fine tuning. So the days are very full leading up. Leading up to the beginning of the tournament, and then in the tournament, we train for 3 hours in the morning. We're in the classroom for 3 hours in the afternoon. We then have massage and physio and all those sort of things that you've got to do to make sure we're 100% fit.
And were you watching all the games that were happening, or pretty much? Yeah.
Yep. Oh, absolutely. Because of course we didn't know appointments until 48 hours before the match. So we had to be ready with having an understanding of how teams were playing. It's always important to have a good feel for the tournament. And of course, we're not just watching the players, but we're also watching our colleagues and saying, okay,
what's working well for them and what's not.
What's working well? What's working well? What's not? How can we improve? As they say, we're the 33rd team there,
So. It's probably also the interest of where and when VAR would kind of get involved, because it, mm-hmm. it obviously mm-hmm. so big. The first World Cup ever with VAR, fairly to some degree untested. Well, not untested. That's unfair to say, but untried at that level. And then all of a sudden, I think all the fans were like, "Oh, when is this actually going to happen?" And then I think it took two or three. I think it was Australia France game that happened. I can't remember if it was
three or
four games in.
Yes, so
we're like, "Oh, okay, maybe VAR isn't that big a deal." And then it started to kind of kick in, and it was great. And kind of coming to your game, the game that you officiated, Nigeria Iceland. Before we get into the VAR piece, how was that experience as a whole? Obviously getting the appointment, you said 48 hours before. Mm. What, as soon as you heard, mm-hmm. what was the 48 hours leading up to it look like for you?
So it was, we were of course pleased with the appointment. It was a good appointment. The match really, every match is important at the World Cup, but this one in particular had a lot riding on it with the outcomes from the two matches before, with Iceland drawing with Argentina mm-hmm. and then Nigeria, I think, just nearly lost to Croatia. So it meant, there needed to be a result coming out of it for both teams to progress. So that was good. And then so we had to travel from Moscow to Volgograd. So there's a bit of that taken mm-hmm. up, and but with the amount of preparation and work that I've done with my team in terms of the lead up, we felt really really looking forward and calm and whatnot. And we got into the pre-match the day before, and then just building into the match, we were just looking forward to it, and it was just a hugely enjoyable experience, walking out and but also feeling very calm and confident in what we could do, as a team.
Yeah. Two completely contrasting teams in terms of style, right? Is there?
Yes.
How do you balance kind of what that first foul? because both countries are probably have a different interpretation of kind of what a foul is. So how important was that first decision, I guess?
It's always nice to get the first one. Yeah, it's nice. It's always nice to kind of get the first one out of the way in terms of a decision. And for me, it was it wasn't a big foul, but it was enough that. And we talked a lot around aerial challenges and use of arms and whatnot. So for me, it was like we need to kind of just set the bar, make sure we don't end up with a situation that we could. For later on in the match, if you allow a lot of that to happen early, it could lead to problems. So, fairly, I had a good look at it and fairly straightforward one to get underway with. And then, but as you said, but we do it. We also, spent, a good hour and a half, almost 2 hours, going through technical analysis of both teams, so we had a good idea of how they play and what we would expect.
And it kind of panned out.
And the first half was, mostly. The first half was very cagey, mm-hmm. And then of course the second half really kind of opened up. But we knew that, especially Iceland would try to absorb some pressure and then look to counter. Mm-hmm. And they did, and then it was more just a question of when would Nigeria sort of open up the throttle per se a little bit more, and in the second half they obviously attacked a lot more with the introduction of Musa and whatnot.
So. Yeah, and so the big decision in the game was a penalty. And that was obviously your first interaction with VAR at the World Cup, I guess. What was going through your mind when that happened? Is interesting to hear the thought process from the person on the field.
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, obviously, we wanted to get the decision live, but it wasn't clear from my vantage point. It was a bit of an unexpected ball backwards to the back corner of the penalty area, and then all of a sudden, you had an attacker with a ball at his foot, and then it wasn't clear whether the defender had put a toe onto the ball or onto the back of the calf. As it was the back of the calf. So we just, at that point, we just immediately just kicked into our processes that we've been training with using VAR. It was very straightforward in the sense that the ball was already out of play. So we just, as per our training, just delay, wait. And I knew they were, I know that they're going to be checking. So, and so as soon as that my VAR said, yep, suggest on field review, I'm like, I've got a pretty good idea. He's gotten in there. So, and then, while I'm moving, I get a little bit more detail of what he's seeing on the screen. So then, but then I, in that sense, once I get to the screen, I am now acting as the VAR, saying, okay, show me again, show me this angle, show me at real speed. And then, of course, me taking the decision to award the penalty.
Yeah, because I think that was the education piece around the World Cup, was the final decision in 99% of cases is always going to be the man on the field. That was really important to know. And looking at the decision, that it is all about angles. So the beauty with the World Cup, I think, I can't remember exactly the number, 60 different angles, I think, at most games. So
yes.
Whereas you yourself and your assistant and that side of the pitch, you had two angles. You're never going to be in the perfect position to get those major decisions. Did the fact that you had VAR influence your decision in any way, or in the sense of, and not just that decision when you were refereeing, does it in other games where you have VAR, are you a little bit more cautious, or do you referee as you always did? How talk me through that.
I try to referee, and we're really encouraged to referee as we always we're really working hard to get ourselves into the best angle to replay and be in the right position to be able to make those decisions. And it does come down to angles, and so there's a lot of work that goes into making sure as best we can to get there. And as you say, there are sometimes when the camera just has the better vantage. I certainly really try to referee without thinking that, I've got VAR behind me, so, it kind of doesn't matter the decision. I want my decisions to be correct. So the biggest thing that has changed in terms of me, and I think philosophically, I think a lot about this, it's forcing referees to, we used to be able to make our decisions just in the, if you say the black box of our own mind, and we would make a decision and we would, whistle and signal and that was it. Now we have to really be good communicators and really being, in essence, open up our mind and our decision-making up
to other colleagues.
Colleagues to say, this is what I'm seeing, this is why I'm doing it. Because of course then they're going to be looking at the screen going, okay, does what I'm hearing matching up with what we're seeing? And so
because that's probably
and that's really important, and I think it makes us better as referees in terms of forcing that thought process and communication.
Do you think you're giving yourself an extra second now when you make decisions, just to almost pre-prepare that communication in your head, or is it similar, exactly the same? I'm just seeing what I'm seeing and it's okay.
No, I think there is that, and certainly, I mean, maybe it's just a little bit personal, but I certainly take that extra second and say, okay, this is a reckless foul, reckless tackle, number six. green, and you know, if it's in the penalty area, okay, penalty. So it does help sometimes prime the decision making, and it means then generally we can get into trouble when we make snap decisions. Yep. Sometimes we need to, but we can get into trouble when we don't go through the process, mm-hmm. the decision making process thoroughly, and we can end up with bad outcomes.
I've kind of been drawing out a flow chart of how a referee makes a decision, and exactly that. Mm. And if you can make that quickly, if you can always think through that, that's the key. So is it careless, reckless, mm-hmm. or excessive force? That's foul, that's yellow, right. Red, and then location of the box, denial of it. And you've got to go through all of these decisions and get it done. So I think it is about process, definitely.
Mm. Very much.
So in terms of VAR, you kind of mentioned philosophically about how the impact has been. What's your kind of perception now that the World Cup's happened? Do you think it's good for the game, and do you think the fans are starting to get on board with it, or is there evolutions that need to come? What's your take as the person kind of really involved in refereeing and VAR? So.
Mm. Mm. I think technology's influence in the game is here to stay. Mm-hmm. I think, as in all things, there was some apprehension about it initially, and then the experience through the World Cup was very positive. We worked very hard on the implementation. There have been different times in different leagues around the world since then, or even before then, where there have been some issues mm-hmm. with it. And that's just a natural part of, I think, how, implementing new technologies and new processes, there's always a learning period and a growth period and some challenges that come with that. I don't necessarily think we've seen the last iteration mm-hmm. of it. So what that looks like in the future, I don't know. Again, the biggest thing is, if we can, the more that the wider refereeing community can communicate the process of what's happening, and then that trickles down into that level of communication and accepted communication that's happening in a match from the elite level down to grassroots level, the more that happens, the more I think easily the implementation or the adaptation of VAR, the easier that will happen.
Yeah, I think one thing from a kind of me being an amateur referee myself at an amateur level, mm-hmm. The one thing I think that helped us referees is with VAR on the World Cup, it just showed how difficult it was, how difficult refereeing was. And actually, I think this season, the behavior, I think just from the World Cup, I think if we can, the easy thing to say is, oh, we can watch it on VAR later on.
Exactly, exactly.
All of a sudden, the players are like, they've got a tough job, and that showed. So thank you, guys. So moving on, you're obviously the World Cup, the Club World Cup. What's the next goal? How do you mm-hmm. set the mm-hmm. next goal, and how do you maintain that kind of love of the game and passion to kind of achieve mm-hmm. what's next?
The love of the game and the passion's the easy part. It's sometimes just having to remind myself of that, going, okay, that's right. Yes, do another lap, train, you get up, you've got to go to the gym this morning, go. But that's generally, fairly straightforward. So, but for me now, looking ahead, I am already starting to build for Qatar in mm-hmm.
2022.
And then of course there's, I'd like to get back to the Olympics in 2020, in Tokyo. And so for me now, it's again, being from such a small refereeing corner of the, or footballing corner of the world, mm-hmm. For me, it's about building my continuing to build my resume per se internationally. I'm from the World Cup. I've it's opened up some doors to do some refereeing. I've been in Saudi doing some matches, professional matches there. I've been at the Super League, Chinese Super League. I was honored to be able to referee the second leg of the Chinese FA Cup a couple of weekends ago, which was a an outstanding experience. And so it's for me now, it's continuing to find these really it's a bit more travel abroad, being involved in refereeing in almost as many different cultures as possible to help, expand the sphere of influence. Yep.
So it's
with the goal of multiple matches at the next World
Cup. it's a mixture of your own personal brand and getting yourself out there, but also learning the different culture and style of football in different countries is going to set you well if the World Cup is your next kind of big milestone.
That's kind of the plan.
So let's talk wider afield about kind of football in general. Is there any law that you would like to change? I think it was in 2016, IFAB launched the Playfair kind of concept, which looked at a variety of different radical changes that could be implemented that they're experimenting. Is there anything that you think needs to change or you would like to change for a selfish reason or for the benefit of football?
It's interesting. In New Zealand, they have a strong hockey, in the US we'd call it field hockey, but hockey background. And there's a professor I've done some work with, and he's constantly going on about, they need to have a quick tap, restart from the touchline. That could be interesting. It's some of the modifications they're doing around, they've trialing the idea of the temporary dismissal especially to manage dissent at the, they're implementing it at a lower or grassroots level. And that's really positive around changing some of the perception and the
culture almost.
What can be the culture of dissent sometimes in the game. And, that's often one of the top two questions I get asked, is how do you deal with the dissent and how do you deal with simulation? Mm-hmm. How do we get rid of this from the game? So those are very positive moves. And one thing I like that, IFAB along with FIFA are looking at the game and saying, okay, how can we make sure that we keep it moving forward? But at the same time, I think wholesale radical changes kind of changes the structure and the nature of the game. So it's striking that balance between making sure the changes are about promoting the game being played, maybe a little bit faster or but not sort of wholesale, crazy
not,
stuff.
Not changing the sport for the sake not like, of it, but more for the,
correct,
the benefit of.
Correct. Yeah. For the benefit, and so and we're trialing a couple of things here, a couple of modifications around restarts from goal kicks. So for now, the ball doesn't have to, for this tournament, it's a trial around ball not having to leave the penalty area, which will be an interesting way to see how teams play with that.
Man City and Liverpool might really like that one.
Yeah. Indeed. So I think it's good to trial some things, but I wouldn't want to see it get too carried away.
And do you have much involvement in kind of training and developing youth referees where you're from? And is that something that's a passion of yours or is that kind of something in the future?
It really is. It is a passion of mine. And not just in terms of necessarily football refereeing, but looking at officiating as a whole in different sports. I'm doing some work locally around what can we do to provide a bit more support and development for At the moment, we're sort of starting a bit at the pointy end with some elite officials across various codes. Mm-hmm. In terms, because a lot of the concepts around decision making, training, preparation, traveling, you can apply those to various sporting codes. So, and there's a lot that we can learn from how other referees manage players. Mm-hmm. You know, like for instance, you know, New Zealand's very strong rugby culture. You know, watching Nigel Owens, the great Welsh referee, watching him again, that's one of those, you know, I glean, you know, there's the personality and the manner and how he deals with that, you know, different players. It's slightly different culturally, but there's stuff to learn. So, so I'm working on that. And that's starting to pick up some steam. And, so ultimately, yeah, there'll be that mix of not only my own personal development, but helping others to develop and opening doors for them as well.
Brilliant. So if you had a room full of young aspiring referees, not necessarily football, could be from any code.
yes.
What are the kind of major pieces of advice you'd give them?
First, probably that it's the long game, not the short game. You have to think of refereeing as... you may have obviously some initial success, but to really be a good official, it's you know, it's the whole 1,000 hours concept. You have to have time in the middle, and you have to be willing and able to recognize your own mistakes and not beat yourself up about them, but learn from them and recognize that we will all make mistakes, and it's okay as long as we don't continue to make the same mistakes over and over. So think of it as the long term. Think of it as, you know, how can I progress over time, and how can I take the whatever situation I find myself in, or, you know, as a young referee, what can I learn from the situation? And that we can learn to be good officials. We can learn to be good referees. You know, we've got to know the laws of the game, but it's also a tremendous opportunity for personal development as well. And if we recognize that, then no matter what the outcome is, if we recognize the underlying process behind it, then, you know, we win, mm-hmm. you know, personally and as officials, I think we help the game improve, you know, we personally improve. So I think looking at refereeing from that perspective is certainly very important. And what I would like to see, I'd certainly encourage young referees coming into the game to think of it that way as well. And old referees, not just young ones.
A lot of referees now are coming from finishing playing, right? So they've had their career.
Yes.
In, which is great.
It's one of my favorite things I love to say to players, you know, as they're, you know, telling me how a decision should be. I'm like, please, that's excellent. When you're finished playing, please come and referee. I'll help you, but come. Then we'll come and talk, you know.
This is a great one. Has anyone taken you up on that yet? Not yet.
We have. Okay. There have been a couple of National League, ex-National League players in New Zealand who have taken put their money where their mouth is and or put the whistle where their mouth was. No, they've taken some and even a couple are still active. One was like, I had to do a refereeing course because his son's playing, mm-hmm. and so club-based refereeing. He's like, I never, again, sort of back to the VAR statement, I never knew it was that challenging.
Yeah.
I always thought you guys had an easy job, but not anymore now. A whole level, you know, much more level of respect. And I was like, oh, good.
You almost wish that they took the course when they start their career.
That's right. You would not believe the number of players that still need to read the law. Yeah. But that's good. That you know, it's happening.
Yeah, brilliant. And so we have a lot of different referees all around the world listening to our podcast and this interview. So thanks for being on here. Is there any particular question that you'd like to ask them? And we'll get a lot of comments and we'll send it back to you in an email. So anything in particular you'd like to ask?
Sure. So thinking about it and you know, if catching some of the media and whatnot, it often comes down to referees saying, oh, there's, or even in society, we need more respect for refereeing in the game. And it's something that I'm, again, hugely passionate about. So my question would be, how do we, as a body of, you know, fraternity, sorority, group of referees, men and women, how do we build respect for referees and refereeing in our society so that people want to pursue it for enjoyment, for being part of the game, but as well as really recognizing it as a pathway towards high performance sport and really being, you know, recognizing it as, hey, when I grow up, I want to be an elite referee, not just a, I want to grow up and play, but how do we sort of shift that perspective a little bit?
That's a great question. I think there's going to be so many different views on how we can do that. And hopefully people can relate to their experience too. Matthew, it has been a great pleasure to chat to you. We really wish you the best while you're out there in Abu Dhabi.
Thank you, Hassan.
And thanks for taking the time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And yeah, I really appreciate the work that you're doing. I think it's great. Yeah, we look forward to having another chat at some time in the future, I'm sure.
This podcast was brought to you by Ref6, the smartwatch and mobile app for football referees. It helps you with timing, match administration, and performance tracking. Simply head over to the App Store or Google Play Store, search for Ref6, and download now.